He's about 455 yards away. He's going to hit about a 2-iron, I think.
This is the School of Motion podcast. Come for the MoGraph, stay for the puns.
But at times I felt like maybe I should only focus on motion graphics and I should be less social and I should focus less on modeling and maybe I shouldn't spend so much time doing motorcycles. Like if I sat down in front of the computer for longer, then I could be that much more advanced in my career. But I don't think that works for me. Like I'm just progressing at the pace that I need to progress and I need to have time for those interests. Otherwise, I just think I'm going to be a crappy designer.
I'm always interested in finding out what makes certain people successful in their field. In motion design, you might think that having a single-minded obsession with design and animation is the ticket to MoGraph greatness. But the truth is that having a diverse set of interests and spending time doing other things can actually come back around and help your motion design career in ways you'd never expect. At least, that's my theory. As evidence of this theory, I present today's guest, the talented and super interesting Angie Ferret. Angie and I connected because we were looking for female Cinema 4D artists to feature in our Cinema 4D Basecamp course. And to be honest, it wasn't that easy to find them. Anecdotally, there seemed to be way more male self-promoting C4D artists than female. And I've been told by several people in the industry that it seems to be harder to find female artists to present their work at events like NAB. But Angie was actually one of the few female presenters at the Maxon booth during the 2017 NAB conference. She got up in front of her MoGraph heroes, her peers, and thousands of live stream watchers worldwide and conquered imposter syndrome live on stage. She's a very interesting person who not only designs and animates in 2D and 3D, but who also works on and rides motorcycles, who models, who is really into the tattoo scene. And after talking with Angie, I think that her uniqueness, her variety of talents and interests have helped her stand out in an industry that is, conservatively, 70 to 80% male. In this interview, we talk about the strange ways that your interests can combine to give you superpowers in your career. We talk about the underrepresentation of female presenters in our industry and what might be done about it. And we go on and on about how great Maxon is because, well, they just are. You'll love this interview, you'll love Angie, and you might just want to start riding motorcycles after this. So let's get to it. Angie Ferret, I'm really excited to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much. Such an honor to be on your podcast. Thank you.
Oh, stop it. Well, thank you for saying that. So Angie, we were talking right before we started recording and I mentioned, you know, everybody that comes on this podcast, I do a fair amount of Google stalking and just, research is maybe like a better word, but it's Google stalking and I try to find out about them. So I have interesting things to talk about and bring up and just try to get to know them. And, you know, most of the people that come on this podcast, it's very easy to find lots and lots about them online, how it relates to their motion design career. And they talk about design and animation and After Effects and all the things you'd expect. But in researching you, I found a whole bunch of other things that you're interested in that are like fascinating and didn't really fit into the stereotype of motion designer. So I'm wondering if we could just start off by, you know, you talking a little bit about your background and how you got into this industry.
Yeah, for sure. So it's actually, I used to do a lot of video editing in high school. I was pretty fortunate to go to a kind of like a semi-private high school that was brand new. So they had a lot of great new gear. So I did a lot of communication technology and did a lot of videography and editing back when it was tape to tape editing. And then when they finally brought in Adobe Premiere for the first time, my teacher had no idea how to use it. So I used to skip my other classes to go and like figure out how to use Premiere. But after high school, then I went to film school for a year and it was a lot of theory and it was just kind of boring to me. So I stopped going there and went to a technical college and did broadcast production. And once I finished that, I took a 1-year post-production course, which kind of We did some Shake, we did some Maya, we learned like basic compositing and animation, just really, really basic. And a component of that was a 1 month internship. So I got an internship in a studio in Toronto, and I was super fortunate because while some of my classmates were sweeping out closets and doing coffee runs, I was actually making stuff for TV. So I got to work on some like map animations and some stuff for like Discovery and some stuff for some sports channels. So before I was even getting paid, I'd walk into like a bar in Toronto and see some of my stuff like on TV. So I just felt like such a rock star. But yeah, most of the stuff I've learned was through the guys that I worked with at the first studio that I interned at and then eventually got a job at. And they were really great. They basically taught me everything. I didn't have a design background. I never went to school for design. So I kind of like learned design while I was learning to animate. But yeah, they were just great and let me watch them work and ask them as many questions as I needed to just during my first job.
It's really funny. Everything you just said happened to me too. Like we have almost the exact same history of getting into this. And one of the things that I definitely connected with was I started in a film program and I thought it was boring too. And I'm curious if you could talk about that a little bit. Like what was it about the film program? Like, was it that program or was it like the process of making films in general? What was it that turned you off?
It was just, I mean, I think it's still useful to know, you know, like mise-en-scène and like framing and, right. You know, how like the history behind filmmaking. And that was all really interesting to me, but I wanted to get my hands on a camera and I wanted to like technically get in there and make something. And I didn't want to direct and I didn't want to produce, but I wanted to like make stuff. I didn't want to sit in a classroom and like analyze every little thing about a film.
It's exactly the same reason. I left the film program for that exact reason because there was so much theory and I knew at the time, like, yes, I get that this is important, but I just want to make stuff.
Yeah.
And then it's funny, I bet we're pretty close in age too. Like when I went to college, they still had Steenbecks that you would edit 16 millimeter on. And then in the video department, they had Avids.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, well, why the hell am I going to like use scissors and tape to edit when there's a computer right there that'll do it? So yeah, so I switched. So what was sort of like the gateway drug that got you into motion design?
So really it was just like kind of having to do it because that was like the job that I got out of college. And I was like, okay, well, I have to do this now. I have to learn it.
Just like, yeah, sink or swim.
Yeah. And I loved it, of course, but it was never, I don't even know if I knew what motion design was like when I was going to film school. It just kind of happened.
Yeah. I'd never heard the term motion design, frankly, until probably like 3 or 4 years ago. Right. Everybody called it MoGraph. And then before that, you were just an After Effects artist.
Yes.
You just did After Effects, right?
Right.
So like on your portfolio site, which we'll link to in the show notes, you know, you have a lot of different types of work on there, not just motion design. There's print work and there's some logo design, this really cool t-shirt design you did. So like which came first? Because you said you don't have a design background, but you've clearly developed some sort of sense of design. How do you balance all those things and where do they all come from, these different projects you get to work on?
Well, the projects really, a lot of them are referrals. So in Toronto, I had a pretty big network of people, just from people that I met going to meetups or people that I worked with that were friends of friends that are looking for somebody that needed something. Yeah, even though I never really studied design, which is kind of funny because I now teach design. But yeah, I've always been kind of artistic. Like as a kid, I used to win every coloring contest that I entered and stuff. And anytime that I had to do a project in high school, I'd always do a video or something like a painting or if that allowed it. I don't really know where that came from, to be honest, but.
Well, first of all, what is a coloring contest? I've never heard of a coloring contest.
Oh, really? You know, when you're a kid and it's Easter. So there's a picture of a rabbit and you just color it with your Crayola crayons.
Oh my gosh, I have to find this. My daughters would absolutely die for that. They color all day long.
That's amazing. Yeah. I don't know if they have them anymore. It might have just been a thing.
Competitive coloring.
Yeah.
I love it. Okay. That is interesting that you teach design now. It doesn't surprise me anymore when I hear people say things like, I teach this, I never actually went to school for it, because I mean, obviously, like I don't think you have to go to a school to learn stuff.
No.
But Yeah. But I'm curious, like, where did you develop your sense of design and the skills that you now use?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was just kind of through people that I worked with. That first job that I had in Toronto, the guys that were there just were really great. Like, if I had any questions about color or, you know, anything, they would give me honest feedback. And I think it just really helped me grow as an artist, like just those guys. Like, I owe a lot of my career to those guys and to, you know, watching tutorials and doing a bunch of research. A lot of the stuff that's on my website, like web banners and any print stuff, it was like a friend needs an ad done or a friend needs a t-shirt design. Can you do it? And I'm like, yeah, I have no idea how, but let me go do some Googling and figure out how to do that. I had to do some screen printing for a beer company and had no idea how to do that. So just spent a bunch of time making a bunch of mistakes and then correcting them and eventually like came out pretty good. But yeah, I had no idea how to do that beforehand.
Well, I'm going to come back to that in a little bit because that seems to be a trait that you possess. You're not afraid to say, yeah, I'll do that. Even though deep down you're like, I don't know if I'm equipped to do that. I don't know if I'm qualified. But I want to talk about, you know, your 3D skills now and sort of, you know, the way that I first heard your name was because you were a presenter at the Maxon booth. I think it was in 2017. So it was in the last year.
Yeah.
And I mean, you were one of the few female presenters, which was really cool to see. So let's talk about, how did you learn 3D? Like, when did you start learning it? And what was the learning curve like?
Well, I had a bit of Maya experience from school. And obviously Maya, this was probably about 9 or 10 years ago, at the time was very vast. And cinema was more for broadcast and motion design. And right. One of the guys at the studio that I worked at was really good. His name's Shadi. He's like one of my mentors. Like, I owe a lot of my career to him. But he was really good. Any of his spare time, he'd just spend playing around in cinema. And anytime like a new grayscale gorilla video would come out, we'd sit in the studio together and watch it and like kind of go through the steps together. So we kind of learned together. And as far as the learning curve, I found it pretty easy to get in and make something and like it looked pretty good, like right off the bat, like compared to working in Maya before, which kind of took me longer just because there's so many more things to actually get in and make something that looks good.
Yeah. So you strike me as someone who's not afraid to like take on these, you know, big technical ordeals. I mean, you kind of have to be like that to get really into 3D. And it's funny because I had the same experience with Maya where, you know, I'm a geek and I'm happy to get dive into some super dense program, but Maya there was sort of like some level where it became too much and Maya like breached that and cinema didn't. And that's why I gravitated towards cinema. And I'm curious, like, you know, now like, was there anything else besides the complexity of it? Like for me, cinema was it just made sense. Like the way it works, it's kind of elegant. But I'm always curious to hear why people like cinema so much. Cause it's clearly like, it's the default thing you use now if you're a motion designer. You know, no one uses Maya in motion design.
Well, it's funny because I actually had an interview with a guy from Maya because he knows that I'm a cinema user and was trying to get people back onto Maya because he noticed everyone was on the cinema. And I gave him a bunch of ideas. And I think the biggest thing for me anyway is just how vast and supportive the community is and how much information there is out there and how willing everybody is to help you develop your skills. And nobody's like holding any of their information close to them and clutching onto it. And like, they just want to share. Like if people know you're using cinema and they know something about cinema, they want to help you. They want to share their knowledge with you so that you get better. And it's just a community. There's just so much information out there to learn and everyone wants to help you. And I think that's really one of the biggest reasons why.
You're definitely right. And I think back to when I started learning it and at first there weren't too many resources. I think there was C4D Cafe, which was pretty good. And then Nick launched Grayscale and sort of changed the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think a lot of people probably credit him with making cinema so accessible. Right. And I think he probably can take a lot of the credit for how widespread it is. Yeah. But it's funny because I was always told by senior artists that Cinema 4D was like a toy and Maya was like this tool. And I believed that for a long time, because when you look at Maya, it's like Houdini. I mean, you can sort of crack it open and do anything you want. With Cinema, you can sort of do that, you know, not quite as deep, but I'm glad, I feel like that's been proven wrong at this point.
But I mean, there's so many tools out there for everything. It's like, what are you using it for?
Right. Like if you're in some pipeline, you know, like you're doing a character animation movie or something, Cinema is probably not the right tool, but it, you mm-hmm. know, and it comes down to that. But I think for motion design, it's just clear at this point. And you mentioned the community too. And you know, Maxon, it's very interesting. Anyone listening who has not been to NAB in the past, I don't know, probably 8-10 years, it's really pretty crazy to go to the Maxon booth, which is, I mean, it's not very big. When you go to NAB, there are booths that I can't even fathom how much they cost, probably millions of dollars, you know, like 2,000 square foot booths. And then you've got the Maxon booth, which is relatively small. And there's always just like 100 or 200 people kind of clustered around it. It's like a black hole that sucks in all the motion designers, you know, the beating heart of it.
Totally. And you stream it online too. And I think there's like hundreds of thousands of people watching as well, which is crazy.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right. So I want to ask you about one more thing before we get into the Maxon stuff, because I'm really curious about the experience of doing that and how that happened. But, you know, 3D and motion design in general is like, so we did a survey last year, and we found, to the surprise of nobody, that there are far more dudes in motion design than females. And we didn't like get specific enough, like, are there more male 3D artists than female artists? But I would assume it's probably even more skewed there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and when we talk about presenting, females are even more underrepresented. I mean, there are less females in the industry, but there's way less females presenting and being like, you know, up on stage and talking about their experiences. So, I'm curious, like, you know, has that ever affected your experience, being like having to, you know, get into this technical or really kind of geeky field where it's mostly dudes? I've heard stories from other guests on this podcast and other females. I'm just curious if you've seen any of that.
Mm-hmm. So for the first, I want to say like 6 or so years of my career, I didn't really notice it. However, I never met another female motion graphics artist. Like, I was the only one that I knew of. Everyone treated me fairly well. Like, all the guys that I worked with at the first studio, there were times that they asked my opinion on certain things to see if, what they might be from a female perspective, which was like nice, like that they were considering what other females would want to see, or if it was too sexy or something. But it wasn't until recently that I've actually had a couple of incidents that were surprising to me, and kind of stifling in a way as well. There was a couple studios that I worked at that were kind of old school marketing and run by kind of, you know, old white guys, and where I was paid less money for doing a job where I was 5 years more technically advanced than some of the male colleagues who were getting paid more than me and technically less skilled, which, I don't know, it just left me feeling kind of bitter and also just confused. And also, yeah, there's been times where I've been touched inappropriately or has said things inappropriately. Yeah, like I'm sure every woman has a story like this, and it's not okay. But I just think it's kind of, those things are similar in most industries, but in tech, there's not a whole lot of women. And I think it is changing. I think that men are used to seeing more women now in the tech industry than they were about 10 years ago when I started. So most places that I walk into, like, nobody's surprised, where I think at first people were surprised to see a female in the industry. I think that maybe some of those things, with the Me Too movement that are going on. And also, you sent out a newsletter about a month or two ago, Erica McKinnon wrote a great letter. I related to a lot of those things, and I think a lot of females do. So it might be the fact that it's still heavily populated, I guess, that maybe intimidates girls a bit, or maybe it's that they're afraid of being ridiculed. I've also read some studies that say that men tend to oversell their skills. Like if they don't, kind of like me in a way, you know, like I'll say yes to something that I am not sure that I can do. Where women tend to only say yes if they know that they can do it. I don't know if that's completely accurate. It's just the things that I've read, and also kind of experienced as well.
Yeah. You said some interesting things. It's really sometimes tough to talk about this stuff because it's hard to know like what's real and what isn't. And so anecdotally, in my experience, if there's someone who is more brash and willing to put themselves out and say, yeah, I can do that, even though they really can't, it's more often than not, it's a male. But then, you know, you meet someone like you and you kind of buck that trend. And there's this really, I wanted to bring up this quote. So we haven't really talked about it yet, but, you know, I mentioned that in doing my research about you, I found like all these neat things that you do. And one of them is you ride motorcycles and you're obviously very into it. And you were, I'd have to look the blog post up, but you were like female motorcycle rider of the month or something like that on the blog. And they interviewed you. And you had this answer to a question that I thought was really interesting. So I'll read it. You said, I really try to challenge gender roles. I tend to gravitate more towards, quote, masculine interests. This gets pointed out a lot in most areas of my life. It is, however, a bit conflicting for me. Sometimes I find it frustrating that I get the whole good for you when people find out that I ride. Not that they're meaning to be condescending in any way. I guess I'm just surprised that it even has to be noted when a female rides a motorcycle. And, you know, I'm curious, like, you know, do you feel that way about, you know, your role as like a female motion designer, sometimes, you know, 3D artist, getting into the weeds technically in this industry? Do you ever feel like people are sort of like, oh, well, that's pretty good for a girl, Angie?
Yeah, for sure. When I was studying television production, people used to ask me, like, seriously, every time I told them what I did, if I was going to be the weather girl. And initially I was like,
oh my God.
Why? Like, why do I have to be the weather girl? Can't I do technical stuff as well? But then, like, also kind of flattered at the same time, like conflicting. But yeah, and I've also had a boss point out to me that I was the first female that he's ever hired in the graphics department, and that he also almost didn't hire me because of my tattoos. And that was just a whole bunch of weirdness.
Wait, why? What would the tattoos have to do with anything?
He was just judging me, I guess, based on some prejudice that he had.
Right.
People with tattoos.
that's almost like a generational thing. Like, oh, tattoos mean you can't be taken seriously or something.
Yeah, totally. And yeah. Well, like with my modeling and with tattoos and stuff, I used to actually have a completely separate alias. I had like another name that I used to model under. Like not 3D model, I mean like actually modeling.
Yeah, I'm glad you clarified that.
Yeah, like being a model. Because I was afraid, like I wanted to keep both of those identities separately. And I had friends who said, oh, in your reel, you should like walk out and like do something sexy. And I'm like, no, I want people to know me for my work. I don't want people to see me and judge me and hire me because they think I'm hot, or not hire me because they think I'm hot, or whatever prejudice they have. So at first I really, really kept those two things separately. But then over time, as people got to know me, like relationships is big for me. So clients that I have, like I tend to know them and be friends with them. So they knew that I model and stuff anyway. So then eventually it's just like, whatever, this is who I am and people can accept me or not accept me. Sorry, I kind of got off track there from your question.
Well, you know, when you were telling this story, I was trying to think like, okay, well, what if, well, this may surprise you, but I've never been asked to model, Angie. That might be, maybe that'll be my next thing. But I was trying to think like, you know, if there was a male model who also, like, you know, modeled and did motion design, would that person feel the need to have, like, a, you know, an alias so mm-hmm. that when clients Google them, they don't come up with, you know, a bunch of, like, professional modeling shots. Mm-hmm. And I don't really know. Do you think that the modeling thing, because there's a bunch of different ways that, like, I guess that could be interpreted. Like, what do you think? What was your fear that, like, they would see your modeling pictures and think, oh, she's a model, she can't be intelligent also, like something like that?
Yeah, I wanted to be taken seriously for my technical skills and not either be not hired for a job because someone thinks I'm just a flaky girl, or hire me and try to hit on me. Like, that was also right. a fear of mine. Yeah.
Right. It's a shame that, I mean, you know, I know, like, there's a lot of, it's sort of like in the zeitgeist right now. Like, everyone's kind of thinking about these things. And I think our industry probably more than others is doing a lot to try and, like, get rid of that and make that not happen. And one of the things I've told a couple people this on the show, like, one of my theories about maybe the reason that there historically has been less female 3D artists, for example, or it may be even more, more importantly, like, less visible 3D artists, like, presenting at places like the Maxon booth and stuff, is that there just haven't been that many people to model themselves after. And I don't mean modeling, like 3D modeling or like, you know, photography. There's three kinds of modeling in this episode. Yeah. But you know what I'm saying? Like, a role model. And,
yes, for sure.
And so, you know, it's really cool to see artists like you. Michelle Ouellette is another one. Erica Gorichow, Lillian Darmono, like, really just, like, brilliant, talented, successful artists that are not afraid to get out there and be vocal. And I think that, you know, my hope is that sort of proves to the up and coming artists, you know, the next generation under us, that, like, it's totally okay to promote yourself and to get out there. So let's talk about this interesting opportunity that popped up for you last year, where you actually got to be at the epicenter of the world of motion design at NAB, which is the Maxon booth. So how did you get the opportunity to present at that booth?
Well, it's kind of interesting. So I was living in Toronto at the time. Well, not at that time, but about a year and a half before that. And I got an email about the Cinema 40 roadshow that was going to be in Vancouver, which is now where I live. And so and it wasn't coming to Toronto. So I was like, oh, I'm going to take a trip to Vancouver and go check out the roadshow. So I did. And I saw Robin. She was presenting there. And that was the first female I actually ever saw doing or working with Cinema 40. So I was, like, blown away by that. And afterwards, I started talking to Matthias and just kind of talking to some other artists that were there. And he had mentioned that he's always looking for female artists to present and asked me if I'd ever want to present. And I said yes. And then some time went by, probably about a year, and he finally contacted me and asked me if I wanted to present. And of course, I said yes. And I was terrified and had to get a presentation together and everything. But it was basically just kind of a fluke again, just like networking and talking to people and, you know, making relationships with people. And yeah. And cause he's always looking for females and it's really hard to find females. So I was just really fortunate.
So how did it feel? You know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, every new Grayscale Gorilla tutorial, you and your coworkers would sit around and watch it. And I'm sure, you know, like the same way I did the first time I met Nick Campbell at NAB, I was like, oh, it's Nick. Oh my God. You know, like, how did it feel to be sort of on the same stage as people like that, that sort of helped you get into Cinema 4D?
It was terrifying at first, for sure. Yeah. So I, like, when I first got to Vegas and NAB and all of the artists sat down for dinner the first night, I was like, I cannot believe I'm sitting here. Like, this just doesn't feel right. but they're all so, so nice and so welcoming. And, like, nobody there is judging you because, you know, you're not super technically inclined or you don't know like every button. They're just like, wow, you're like, they're like super stoked that you're there with them and you're also an artist and you have the same interests and they want to help you. But I actually introduced all of the artists as well as presenting and kind of like helped out with the booth and stuff as well. But the first couple of days of presenting, I was so nervous. I forgot a couple of the guys' names when I was introducing them. It was super embarrassing. yeah, but
I've done that before. I've been the MC before and it is terrifying.
You especially know? I'm like, oh my gosh, I have to introduce Nick Campbell now. Are you kidding me?
Oh my God, I know. Oh, it's Nick Campbell. Oh. So I actually watched your presentation. Mm-hmm. I did my homework and I watched it. And I got to tell you, you did not seem nervous. You know, sometimes you can tell when people are nervous, but you like, I'm sure you were nervous, but you covered it up. So I'm curious, like, where does that come from? The ability to be really nervous, but like, you know, hide it.
Well, yeah, I was so nervous. I'm glad that it didn't come across. I actually haven't been able to watch my own presentation back because I know I messed a couple things up and I don't want to like see them. But yeah, I think I just really, really prepared. I practiced my presentation like 50 times. And yeah, I kind of have a bit of a performer in me. That's, I think, one of the reasons why I model and a reason why I teach as well. But yeah, I think modeling has helped me. I started modeling when I was about 20 to actually get over some crippling shyness that I had. That was kind of like my tool to like get out of my shell. So that helped me a lot.
How much modeling versus motion design do you do? Like, are you doing a lot of both or is one sort of more, you know, more common?
Motion design's always been first and foremost. Modeling was kind of just in my spare time at first, and then it kind of picked up a lot, but it was still only like maybe 1 or 2 days a week. And now I actually haven't done a whole lot since moving to Vancouver. It's just a different industry here. Toronto has a big alternative industry and indie fashion design industry, and Vancouver doesn't have a lot. So I've only done a handful of shoots since I've been out here. I also, I don't know if it's evident, have a bit of a problem like focusing on one thing. Like I like to be doing a whole lot of things. And this year, I actually like have decided that I'm going to really try to focus on teaching and try to focus on doing motion and kind of if modeling things come up, I'll do them. But I'm not like seeking them out as much right now.
I love it. I really think that, you know, doing modeling, I've never done modeling, so I don't really know what it's like. But I've played in bands. I've gotten on stage and been afraid and done it anyway. And you know, I've gotten up and given speeches. And first of all, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm assuming that the first few times you do a modeling gig and I don't know how many people are around, if there's like, you know, a dozen people, but they're all staring at you and waiting for you to look the right way. That must be pretty nerve-wracking, oh, right? Yeah. And I'm assuming that is it kind of like, is it performing? Like what do you do like when you're modeling?
Oh yeah, it's totally performing. People are constantly, you know, touching your face and touching your hair and putting clothes on you. And yeah, you have to, you're like, everyone's looking at you. Though everyone's super nice, like a common thread with all of my interests is always the community and always the relationships that I make from the things that I do. But yeah, people are there to help you and support you. And I mean, if you don't feel like being a comedian, like in between shots or whatever, you don't have to. You can just stand there. No one's going to judge you. But yeah, I would take an interest in everything and like ask people about, you know, ask the photographers about their careers and ask the makeup artists about their careers and just like genuinely take an interest in them.
When you started modeling, did you have imposter syndrome? Because in your Maxon presentation, I think one of the first things you said was that you sort of felt like an imposter being up there with like, you know, the Grayscale Gorilla team and all the other artists. And I'm just curious, like, did you have to deal with imposter syndrome in modeling too?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It was, I don't know. I don't think anyone maybe some people do think that they're like the most beautiful person. And again, it's like one of the reasons why I got into modeling was to overcome a lot of things. And yeah, I felt kind of like a fraud at first. And I didn't know how to move my body and I didn't know what angles were right. A lot of times things that you do with your body that feel weird actually look really good in a photo. So it was just kind of learning that. And everyone that I worked with was super nice. So they give you a lot of pointers. They're like, oh, do this, do that, but don't ever make you do anything that you're not comfortable with, which is great. So yeah, after just doing it a couple times and knowing that people are people and that people are going to support you regardless of if you mess something up or if something looks stupid, they're not going to print it, obviously. Yeah, so knowing that kind of really put my mind at ease.
So let's go back to the Maxon thing. So getting up in front of, you know, a bunch of like motion designers, 3D geeks, and, you know, Nick Campbell's over on the side watching. And then there's like, you know, thousands of people watching and you have this imposter syndrome, like, oh my gosh, what am I doing here? How do you overcome that? Because it sounds like you've had to overcome that, not just in motion design, but in modeling and maybe, and I'm sure in other areas too. And you seem to be able to do it and good at it. So I'm curious, like, how you talk yourself into doing these things. How do you get over that fear?
Yeah. So for me, I think actually I never even heard the word imposter syndrome before listening to your podcast. but I think just knowing that other people feel the same way and reminding myself that everyone's just human and everyone has the same or similar feelings really puts my mind at ease as well. And knowing that the community is super supportive and that they want you to succeed really helped. I also do a lot of mindfulness stuff as well. So that helps me, like meditating and just kind of watching your thoughts and knowing that your thoughts aren't actually you. But yeah, I think the biggest part for me is knowing that the community is supportive. And if you make a mistake, that nobody's going to ridicule you for it. They just know that you're human.
Let's dig into that a little bit. When you do mindfulness or meditation, what are you doing? Are you using Headspace? Are you doing something else?
Yeah, I've used Headspace. I use a couple apps. There's one called Aware. Right now I'm doing a weekly mindfulness course. So I go once a week and we do like a meditation together and then kind of analyze it. But it's more about like looking at your thoughts and changing your thought patterns. So people say, oh, I should have done this or I shouldn't have done that a lot. And shoulds are very dangerous. So rather than saying I should do this, I say, oh, I want to do this. So that helps me a lot. Like just knowing I have power over the things that I'm doing and power over my own thoughts.
Yeah, I love, so I've on and off meditated and done Headspace and it, like if left to my own devices, this podcast would be a lot weirder than it normally is. but I want to bring it up because when it comes to like performance anxiety, which is, that's essentially like what imposter syndrome is, you sort, you know, or stage fright. I think that that's actually a really powerful tool to kind of conquer that because what you said that you are not your thoughts, your thoughts are things that happen. And then you are the way you react to those thoughts. That's kind of a strange concept. And I've only ever encountered it in this sort of like mindfulness community. So has that been helpful for you doing meditation and mindfulness stuff?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's been points in my career as well where I felt like I should be further than I am. Sometimes I still have those thoughts, obviously, but I'm able to be compassionate with myself and know that I'm still learning and see where I am in my own journey of motion graphics and life in general.
Yeah, there's another piece to the whole meditation thing, which comes up if you know, the deeper you get into it, which is mindfulness is a big part, but then also gratitude. And that's something that personally I have to work on a lot is just remembering like, you know, yeah, this is a problem. Yeah, this is stressing me out. Oh my gosh, this didn't get done. But if I just stop and I say, look around, you know, like what could I be grateful for right now? Well, a million things, you know? And even in those moments of like deep stress, you're standing up there, your presentation's about to start, the camera turns red and it's broadcasting to the world. But you've gotten this cool opportunity. I mean, it's, you know, you're among your heroes and your peers, and, you know, and I don't know, maybe we'll do a whole episode on meditation one of these days. I'm a big fan. So I want to talk about something that I've heard from multiple people in the industry. We kind of mentioned it briefly, but it's that it's not just that there's an underrepresentation of female presenters, not everywhere. Like, a lot of conferences now are doing a great job of sort of like trying to level it out. But when it comes to things like, you know, finding female artists to come present at, you know, a booth at NAB or to do like video lessons or things like that, it's actually seems to be difficult, more difficult to get a yes from a female artist than a male artist, anecdotally. And I've heard this from a lot of people. And you know, you mentioned that there's, you know, that maybe it's the idea that males are more likely to say yes to things they're not qualified for, or that, you know, or to just take chances. But I'm curious if you have any thoughts or insights into why that might be true, you know, that it's harder to get female presenters.
Yeah, I think that is really a big one, is just that maybe they don't feel super confident in their skills, or it might even be, you know, the sense of the old boys club that it still is. And that can be a bit intimidating as well. I know for me, I was super scared, and there were times where I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't do this. Like, my skills are nowhere near, you know, these other guys that are on the bill, like, what am I doing? But for me, it was just like, if an opportunity that's this big presents itself, I know that I would regret saying no to it. I feel like I have to take advantage of everything that comes my way. I don't think I did the greatest job I could have at NAB, but I'm still happy that I did it, and hopefully I get the opportunity to do it again. I'm not sure. You know what? I might actually ask a lot of my female friends that do that work with cinema and see if they would actually do it. And if not, like, dive into why they would say no. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to hear like as many answers to that question as possible. I suspect there's like a million reasons. Mm-hmm. And so I get the impression, Angie, that you are probably a little more, I don't know what the word is, like, I don't know if ambitious is the right word, but like, you're just more willing to take a risk maybe than the average person, you know, to say yes to things that are really scary and to get up in front of a crowd where you could fall flat on your face and Cinema 4D could crash and you could forget Nick Campbell's name or something like that, you know, but you've got a quality about you for one reason or another that lets you push through that. So I'm wondering, like, what advice would you give, you know, a female artist who, you know, is at the NAB, you know, at the Maxon booth this year and starts chatting with Paul Babb or Matthias, and they say, hey, would you be interested in presenting? What advice would you give them to get over that initial, oh, no way I should be doing that?
I think just to remember that everyone is on their own journey and that those guys are going to embrace you no matter what stage you're at. If you're a beginner, if you're advanced, they're gonna love you and they're gonna help you grow. And even if you screw something up or you make a mistake, it's just gonna really be a learning tool for learning for you, rather than something you're gonna look back on and say, "Oh, I really, you know, screwed that up." It's just gonna make you grow in so many ways, like relationship-wise and internally and as an artist. That, yeah, you just gotta like power through and get through those nerves and get into a headspace where you're just in your work and sharing your knowledge with other people.
Yeah, meditate, maybe some kava, you know. Yeah. And get over it. Yeah, and I'll say too, you know, I've spent a little bit of time with Matthias and I've talked to Paul Babb a couple of times, and Maxon is a pretty special company. Like, it is not, I mean, it's probably mostly dudes, but it's not a boys club at all. Like, it really is not.
No, I didn't get that sense at all. No, from none of those guys. They're all just, they don't even see gender or race or anything. They just see 3D artists.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the way it should be. All right. So I want to dig into this idea that I've kind of latched onto in the last couple of years that I think you're a good example of. So I stole this idea from Scott Adams, who's the creator of Dilbert. And I don't know why he should be the guy that came up with this, but there's this idea of a talent stack where you know, like you can be successful in a field by being really, really good at one thing, but it's actually easier and more likely if you are pretty good at like five things. And, you know, so like I always use the example, you know, I'm not a good designer. Like I'm an okay designer. I'm a pretty good animator. I also am a musician. I've played drums. I'm a good musician, I think. And I also used to do voiceovers.
Oh, wow.
And there's all these weird things about me that like somehow adds up to like, hey, I'm good at making tutorials, right? Like who would have thought, you know, and I did, none of that was on purpose, but by pursuing all these different interests, it sort of turns into this skill that, you know, and you've got this really interesting sort of list of things, right? You're a designer, you're an animator, you're into 3D, you ride motorcycles. And in the interview, you even said that you would like to build your own motorcycle one day. And you model and you're into tattoos. So like, I'm curious if, you know, have you seen any weird ways where your outside interests that have nothing to do with motion design on the surface have ended up being really useful?
Yeah, for sure. It is funny because I never, like you said, all of my interests, I never really thought about them like equating to something bigger. I always just saw them as like individual interests. But yeah, I think that, you know, a lot of those interests and hobbies that I have, I've made a lot of great relationships from. So I, even just from working with people with tattoos or knowing people with tattoos in the tattoo community or riding motorcycles, like I've gotten actual jobs from people that have similar interests as well. But also like motorcycling is meditative for me. So when I'm sitting in front of a computer for 8 or 10 hours going out for a ride, I can come back and like see something completely differently than I did before. And I used to like teach fitness as well, which I think also kind of helps me with teaching now and maybe even my public speaking. And teaching really helps me like be a better designer. Like I feel like since I've been teaching, I've learned so much more and so many ways of doing things and seeing things than I had ever before.
That's interesting that you brought up the motorcycle being kind of your, you know, your meditative time. Cause I think that, I mean, that's something I never would have thought of, you know, like, and that's really important. If you are a motion designer, chances are you sit in front of a computer for, you know, 6 to 8 hours a day, and that's not very good for you. And it's funny because when I used to run a studio and I was like stuck on a project or I was stuck creatively or I couldn't figure something out in After Effects, I would usually come up with the answer by running. Like I'm a pretty serious runner but I never thought of running as an asset to my motion design career, but I guess in a weird way, that kind of was. And it sounds like motorcycling. I was sort of assuming like, if you're like, do you like fix motorcycles? Like, do you, you know, sort of like get in there with a wrench and like take the thing apart and do all that too?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely.
I thought that maybe that would like translate somehow into, you know, to do that, you have to be very detail focused and keep the whole in your head while the parts are scattered in front of you, which frankly, it's like kind of similar. Like if you're doing a really deep Cinema 4D project, sometimes it feels like that.
Right. Yeah, you're very right. I never actually connected that, but I totally agree with you. Yeah, I love that. I love taking my motorcycle apart or fixing things. And I always feel like a sense of such accomplishment when I figure out something that's wrong with it and it actually works after. I'm actually building a computer right now, which I've never done before either. So that kind of, it's kind of similar. I have to like go and watch some tutorials and figure out how to do it and see if it'll actually work at the end.
Yeah. I mean, this is just my theory. Like, you know, that what I try to do sometimes when I see someone like you that's had success in these different fields, I try to sort of reverse engineer it. You know, I always like with these episodes, when I interview people, I always in the back of my mind, I'm trying to figure out how there can be a takeaway that's useful for someone who, you know, takes an hour of their time, or hopefully they know that they can speed up the podcast. There's like a little button that can play at double speed. But like, you know, they're listening to us talk for an hour and I'm like, I hope they get something really useful out of this. And, you know, hearing your story and seeing what you've been able to do, to me, it seems like you're like these different things that, you know, are not obviously connected actually kind of combine to give you some superpowers. And there's kind of this idea of like, it's kind of a platitude, you know, like if you want to be a good designer, lead an interesting life, you know, and it's kind of easy to say that. And I think when people hear that, they think, oh, that means I should like go travel. So I've seen neat things that I can reference when I design stuff. But I think it actually works better to be like, no, go learn to like ride a horse or something. You have no idea. That will somehow make you a better motion designer.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just rambling. Does this sound like accurate at all?
Or is oh yeah. No, I totally agree. Even with modeling, I feel like that helped me be a better like photo editor and how to color correct things better. And to know framing better and know like see angles and shapes differently as well. But yeah, I totally agree. Like everything definitely adds up to what I am.
That's awesome. So, I mentioned it earlier, like, you know, in terms of guests on this podcast, doing my research / Google stalking on you was like by far the most interesting because you just got a lot of neat, unique things. You know, and I'm just curious, like, have you ever felt pressure like, oh, but like, I look at these motion designers and they, you know, they all kind of are like similar and I'm way different. I have these totally different interests. Is that like, did that ever enter into your mind? Or have you always just sort of been like, nah, I'm just going to do my thing and hope it works out?
Yeah, no, I definitely have compared myself to people and do compare myself to people. I know the way that I conduct myself on social media. I also actually used to teach social media, and I'm doing the completely wrong things. Like most people have a motion graphics page and they only post their MoGraph work, but I try doing that and it just doesn't work for me. Like I need to be who I am and I need to show all of who I am. Also, looking at other people, other people's work, I feel like those people are very hyper-focused and it might just be the way that they're conducting themselves. But at times I felt like, damn, like, you know, maybe I should only focus on motion graphics and I should be less social and I should focus less on modeling and maybe I shouldn't spend so much time doing motorcycles. Like if I sat down in front of the computer for longer, then I could be that much more advanced in my career. But I don't think that works for me. Like I'm just progressing at the pace that I need to progress. And even though I'm focusing a bit more this year, I still like, I need to have time for those interests. Otherwise, I just think I'm going to be a crappy designer or I'm not going to enjoy it. And that's going to show in my work.
I think you're probably right. And so I had a question I wrote down that was, it was intended to be kind of snarky, mm-hmm. which was like, I went to your website and I looked at your demo reel and it's 4 years old. Yeah. And I was going to be like, come on, Angie, why is it 4 years old? So, well, I'll just leave it there. Let me ask you, why has your demo reel not been updated in 4 years?
Well, I think that maybe I have an old one linked on my website, but I do have one that I cut before I went to NAB and it was, I only updated it because I was like, I can't go to NAB with a 3 year old reel.
That's awesome.
It does have a lot, like there is a lot of old work on there, which I am still proud of. But the last 2 or 3 years, I've spent a lot of time working on some corporate stuff that I am, it's not the most interesting stuff that I would want to put on a reel. So that's one reason why it's kind of the older stuff that I find would be more interesting as opposed to like boring bank stuff.
Do you, like, so when you have, you know, time where you could be like working on your demo reel, see, I've run into this too, like in the past where I have time that I could be spending on my demo reel, which I should be doing because mm-hmm. that's what you do when you're a motion designer. You're always working on your reel and you're always doing spec projects and personal mm-hmm. projects. But I'd actually rather go, you know, like run 10 miles or go play drums for an hour, you know, whatever. And I always try to like tell people that like focusing too much on motion design can actually be kind of bad for your health.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it seems from the outside, I don't know, maybe like secretly you really like spend all day thinking about motion design, but it seems like you've a pretty balanced outlook. And I'm just curious, like, where does motion design fit for you in your life? Is it like, is it the most important thing and that's all you think about? Or is it like, no, like it's kind of in the middle. You got modeling, which is cool. You got motorcycles, which are awesome. Mm-hmm. Maybe you've got like family, you know, stuff like that.
Well, there was a time before I left Toronto, actually, where I was not balanced. Like I was doing everything to the extreme. And I was working like 18 hours a day doing motion graphics, and then I would book a shoot on the weekends, and I worked at a motorcycle shop on Saturdays, and I was really into fitness at the time, and it was just, I was burning out. So now I actually, like, I do motion graphics, you know, for a normal amount of time during the day, like 8 hours or sometimes 10 hours, sometimes less, sometimes two or three. And then I really make it a priority to work on myself as well, to meditate and to, like, fitness is very important to me, and to see friends. Because I was finding when I was focusing too much on my hobbies and on MoGraph that I wasn't nurturing my relationships. So now, yeah, it's just sometimes obviously I have to work more than others, but I try to keep it balanced. Otherwise I just burn out and I'm not happy. And if you're not happy, what's the point in doing anything?
That's really good advice. I mean, for everyone listening, if you follow, I don't know, if you're like active on social media, and you follow, like, you know, there's a lot of people in motion design that they talk kind of like, you know, wake up, MoGraph, sleep, you know, repeat. And it may seem like that's what it takes to, you know, from the outside to be really successful. But I can tell you that, like, you know, Angie's a great example. I mean, Sander van Dijk is another one who, like, has crazy interests completely outside the realm of motion design that augment his genius ability to use After Effects the way he does. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have our takeaway here, Angie, which is, you know, be interesting, like, and follow your interests, because even though it may not be obvious, the modeling gig that you get offered, hopefully I'll get offered one. And I'm kind of curious now. I kind of want someone.
I'll refer you.
Yeah. I kind of want people touching my face. And but yeah, like, you never know, because that's going to help you get over your shyness, which is then one day going to lead to you saying yes to a gig presenting for Maxon at NAB.
Exactly.
Right?
Yep.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Angie, thank you so much for, you know, having this conversation. You're super interesting, and I really hope to see you presenting more at Maxon and in the future. I think you actually are probably a role model at this point. You know, like, you're someone like who doesn't fit the, you know, the mental model of what a 3D artist typically looks like and acts like. And I think that's awesome. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm really glad to hear that and kind of surprised, but thank you.
I want to thank Angie for coming on and sharing her experience with everyone. Make sure you check out her work at angieferret.com. You know, we tend not to make a lot of noise about this at School of Motion, but we really do want to see an industry where it just doesn't matter if you're male, female, white, black, blue, purple. And personally, I think that having more female role models out there like Angie is kind of a no-brainer way to help the next generation of motion designers see that this is not a one-size-fits-all industry and that having your own unique story is really a good thing. If you dug this episode, would you mind taking 2 seconds and giving a review, maybe 5 stars on iTunes? It really helps us spread the word about the podcast, and we'll owe you a beer or a kava if that's your thing. That's it for now. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.